This is the Digging Deeper podcast, where we engage in today's questions from a Christian perspective. Hello, everyone. I'm here with Pastor Marty. He is the head pastor here at Burke Community Church. He did his doctoral dissertation on transgenderism. And today we're going to discuss a little bit about transgenderism and discuss the idea of the mind and the world and the relationship between those two. Well, last season we talked about, I think you were our first guest, and we talked about what is truth. And one element of that is this idea of the mind and the world that you live in, and like, what do we do when those things are at odds? And so I just would love to, you know, maybe take it back in history and like hear your thoughts on what that's been like in human history. And I know a subject you know about is Gnosticism, which is, you know, obviously an expression of that worldview. So I'd love to just, you know, give you the floor and share with us kind of maybe what that is, what Gnosticism is, and how that relates to this idea of the mind's perception versus reality, or the physical, tangible reality.
Yeah, well, Gnosticism, I mean, it was a Grecian philosophical system that came about shortly, well, scholars debate whether it happened during the time of the writing of the Pauline epistles or shortly thereafter, but some of the things that Paul argues about seem to be as if he's addressing Gnostic tendencies, like pre-Gnostic thinking, which probably is. So it's a perversion of truth, perversion of sound teaching, sound doctrine. Gnosticism, gnosis comes from the Greek word to have knowledge. So if you had their esoteric knowledge, their secret mysterious knowledge, then you had arrived and could be saved, as it were, within their system. So it was arriving and attaining their level of enlightenment. These are all things easily borrowed by the transgender movement, because this is, I mean, they're pushing it through the schools and everything to enlighten everybody. It's the same concept. If you're enlightened like they are, then you've arrived, and you can, you know, push toward nirvana in a society, as it were. But if you're unenlightened, then you're a problem.
So knowledge plays a big role.
Knowledge, yeah. Huge knowledge, and very arrogant. You're either part of their philosophical system, or your system is inferior and needs to be eradicated. Same thing you see today. You know, so you accept our worldview and buy into our esoteric knowledge, or your knowledge base is inferior. So you see that arrogance being displayed as they push non-reality on us, wanting us to embrace it. But in Gnosticism, the cosmos was created by a god that had issues, basically, a god that had problems. And as he created the cosmos, he created beings, and each being was a little less god than the last one. And those in their system were called emanations. And so when you get down to the final emanation, that would be like the Christ man, who's the final creator God. But he's so far removed from God, he's kind of quasi-God. There's a little deity about him, but he's got a lot of man about him, and then there's issues about him. And he creates a cosmos that's not sinless, but has all kinds of issues, and it's full of evil. And so in their system, the cosmos is the problem. The cosmos is full of evil. The material world is evil. What matters is the mind. The mind is superior and must gain their esoteric knowledge of things. And once you buy into their system of thinking, then you can arrive at a place of fullness, or what they call pleroma in Greek, a place of fullness, or what we might call salvation. So it's salvation with no savior.
It's interesting, I mean, because as you're describing that, I hear a lot of words that like resonate with Christian ideology, like this idea of the world being incomplete and imperfect, and this idea of like, even, you know, knowledge, like Colossians talk about, like the fullness, Christ is the fullness of God, or there's this fullness of wisdom and knowledge. So how do you parse those and say, well, yes, both of these have this idea of there's the world, but it's fallen. Because like as a believer, you believe that there's this fallen world, but also there's this greater reality. So what are the differences?
So in our thinking the world has fallen because man has fallen. So when men fell, the world fell. Mm. In their system, the mind is everything, and the world really doesn't matter all that much. Mm. And so it headed in two directions in Gnosticism. You either became an ascetic Gnostic, like a monk, and cut yourself off from the world, as it were, and did austere things to control the body so that your mind could be improved. Or since the external world didn't mean anything, then you can engage in any kind of licentious behavior that you wanted to, any kind of perversity, and it wasn't perverted. Mm-hmm. And so they headed into two directions, and the majority of them heading it toward the let's enjoy sex to the fullest thing mm-hmm. and any form thereof. And so, because it didn't matter, your mind is what it was pursuing was the most important thing. The body didn't matter. Mm-hmm. Again, it's easy to see how transgenderism picked that up, because mm-hmm. your mind is that which is the essence, the most important thing, and what happens to your body, the external world, is secondary.
Yeah. Can you connect that more, like those ideas of like the mind versus the world, like to how that's played out in transgenderism?
Connect how the mind
like that
relates in their system. I mean, that's a big discussion. I mean, in their system, the mind so in their system, the mind has one concept of how it sees reality, which is the opposite of what the body is appearing. So in their thinking, you know, if you have you're born a man, but your mind is in your thinking female, then it doesn't matter that your anatomy is man. Mm-hmm. Your mind's telling you you're in the wrong body, and so mm-hmm. therefore you treat not the mind, you treat the body. Mm-hmm. So that's when you would do, you know, what they would call gender affirming care, which I think is a misnomer based on medical evidence, but they call it gender affirming care. So you would change the body to then help the mind be at a place of peace, which is another deception, because it doesn't lead to peace. When you study national, like 40-year studies, like out of Sweden, it doesn't lead to inner peace. Mm. It leads to great inner turmoil and chaos, but another discussion. Mm. So instead of treating the mind as a problem and how it sees reality, they treat the body, not the mind. We look at like an anorexic person who has a mind-body problem, mm-hmm. like a transgender does, and we treat the mind of the anorexic high school student, because we realize the problem is not the body, because it's a 5'7", 110-pound senior in, mm-hmm. in high school. You can look at her and go, wow, she's got a nice physique, she's in great shape, but in her mind, she's thinking she's a 250-pound female and looks terrible and has got to do things, you know, to get a place of health and wholeness. Mm-hmm. So she does radical things to try to match her body with her mind, but mm-hmm. but the mind's the problem. So it's the same thing.
Yeah.
So they won't use the same kind of techniques with a transgendered person to help them. They immediately begin to do radical surgery and hormone treatment, estrogen treatment, all that they do to try to fix the body, when they really should be addressing the mind. Mm. So just as you would with an anorexic person, you would not treat their body, because their body is not the problem. Mm-hmm. Their mind's the problem and how it sees their body. Mm-hmm. So it's the one-to-one correspondence when you look at the mind-body problem with transgenderism is, why are we treating the body, you know, of a 12-year-old girl or boy, and we're not treating their mind, mm-hmm. which is misunderstanding the reality which is around them, which was our last discussion. Mm-hmm. So that's the issue. We, who don't look at reality like that, look at someone who's anorexic and whatever, honey, you're fine. You don't need to binge and then throw up and all, do all that happens to them mm-hmm. to try to find a place of peace in their own mind. No, you need to fix your mind, not the mm-hmm. body. So why wouldn't you do the same thing for a transgender? Mm-hmm. And they don't.
Mm. Yeah, what do you think, you know, as someone who's outside of that process specifically in like a transgender or bulimia scenario, what do you think interacting with them, with someone who has that mind thought process looks like? What do you think compassion looks like? What do you think, you know,
like on a, I mean, on a less global scale and less like systematic scale?
I mean, like, how do you talk to him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, we had a man in our church whose daughter, I think she was a high school student at the time, a couple years ago, you know, came and told her mom and dad that she thought she was transgender, and she wanted to head in that direction. And, you know, the parents loved on her, said they still accepted her, still wanted to be in her life, still wanted to talk to her, and did all those things. They didn't write her off, put her, you know, made counseling available for her if she wanted it. She eventually went to counseling. It took about a year. And now the dad told me the other day that his daughter is, you know, on to being a, you know, a young, healthy woman who understands how God has made her and that it's special and that there's not a mind-body conflict. You know, her problem was her mind. Mm. It wasn't her body. And loving on her, accepting her, talking with her, you know, really helped her to go to a place of health and wholeness.
Yeah,
I remember my wife and I ran into that couple one time. I think it was at a Marshall's store, and we ran into the young lady who was dressed in a very bizarre fashion and stuff like that. And as I was talking to the dad, my wife, who didn't even really know the people because of all the parishioners that we have, spent all of her time just focusing on the young lady, just talking to her, you know, as if she was just a normal young, you know, high school student or whatever she was at the time. And the dad told me later that the fact that my wife sat and focused on her and spent so much time talking to her and asking her how her life was going and having a quality conversation with her meant a ton to her because she was accepted and she wasn't looked down upon. And, you know, it's doing things like that.
Yeah.
Being the hands and feet of Christ. Christ hung out with those people. But he didn't accept them where they were at. He called them onward and upward to greater things. And we need to do that. But you have to earn a right to be able to speak to them. And that's what that family did. Not all families act like that, but that's what that family did. And their daughter is now what we would term healthy and moving on in her life, because her mind-body problem is not a huge issue anymore. And most of them grow out of it statistically anyway. But
I think something that's really cool about that story is like the element of time. It's not just here's where this person is, well, let me just hit them with the truth and let just like keep doing that. It was this, there was clearly a lot of patience from the parents and love and I've been thinking about this verse in John where Jesus says to the disciples, like, basically, you're not ready for all. There's more I have to tell you, but you're not ready. And so even Christ has this timing in what's true, that like, yeah, this is true, but we don't need to, that's not, you know, there's an appropriate time to bring that up or to have those conversations, but not every conversation is that discussion. Some conversations are just, how's life going? And, you know, what are you interested in? And like you were saying with your wife.
And I have a neighbor in my neighborhood, same thing, college, where her daughter's now graduated from college, but same thing, kind of a lost soul, trying to find herself, has a lot of LGBT people in her life who are telling her, you know, that she should try transgenderism and all that kind of stuff. So she's thinking that's the course of her life because she feels like she's got a mind-body problem, you know. You know, I still talk to the girl. I still, because I see her when she's out. It's not like you know, they're like leprous or something. They're a broken person that needs, you know, quality friends in their life to love and respect them, tell them things they may not want to hear when the opportunity's right, and listen to them and talk to them. So, and that's what Christ did. He pulled up alongside of people and talked to them. So, you know, I can tell you all the reasons why Gnostic thinking is wrong, why it's still alive and well today, but I would never sit down with somebody struggling with all that and say, hey, let's talk about Gnosticism and how you have bought into a philosophical system that is erroneous and false and dangerous and huh?
You know, yeah.
No, but it just helps it helps a Christian understand where they come from and how they think. They have, I bet you, if you sat down and talked to any of them about it, they would have no clue as to what Gnosticism is at all.
Yeah, I don't think I would know what it is outside of being in church.
And I mean, and if you follow it, I mean, because it goes through history, because in my dissertation, I had to follow it through history philosophically, but it's a thread. Mm. So, you know, philosophy is looking at how do we think about our world? Mm-hmm. You know, and so the Gnostics, that's how they looked at the world. You know, later, if you fast forward, when you get to like Rousseau, you know, Rousseau's view was man was great when he was in an Edenic type environment and he lived like a savage and could just enjoy his desires to the fullest. Man is only jacked up and messed up when he forms himself into cities and societies and they put rules and regulations on him and restrict his freedoms and stuff. So Rousseau was like basically what I would classify it. He had been a great hippie in the 1960s when I was growing up. It's like, hey man, do your own thing. Mm-hmm. That's when you find the fullness, the most enjoyment in life. Do whatever you want with whoever you want, whenever you want. I mean, that was the 60s, but that was Rousseau, you know? Mm-hmm. So he came along and began to teach that kind of thing. And that easily fits into transgender thinking is, you know, well, there's not two sexes and two genders. There is many genders, and then you're then free once you bifurcate the sex and gender, then you're free to do whatever you want to do. And so this is Rousseauian thinking of doing what you want, and how dare you question what I want to do because it's my version of truth as I know it. It's true to me. And so when you go back and you look at philosophy, which I'm sure none of them really do, because it's, you know, it's just ancient thinking, but it's still.
How many of us look at philosophy?
Who does? I mean, that's boring. But when you read it, you're like, whoa, that's totally what I see going on. Restructuring of society, which is what Rousseau did, around basically hedonism. Do what you want to do. You know, Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher after Rousseau, you know, came along and was answering, you know, the question, how do you view your world? Because how does a transgender view the world? My mind says one thing, my body's saying something else. My mind's more important than the body, so I need to change the body. So, you know, but Kant came along in his day, and how do you view the world? Well, his thinking was you can know in your mind what you think is reality, but you can't know for sure everything external to you is really there. So like, you know, the coffee cups that are here, the tables, the chairs, you, the microphone, you know, I can see all these things, but perhaps it is my mind that has projected these things as realities, but they don't really exist. I know I can know for sure what's in my mind, but I don't really know for sure what's outside my mind. Therefore, my mind is that which creates reality. So what's a transgender do? Same thing. You know, I can look at my body and see it looks like I'm a man, but in my mind I'm thinking I'm a woman. So since my mind has a greater power than the body, which is external, I've probably projected all this, then I can modify it.
Yeah.
I can change it. It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're sitting around studying philosophy thinking, how can we be Kantian in our thinking? They're not doing that. They're not doing that at all. But if you do study philosophy, As Solomon said in Ecclesiastes, but, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. These are systems that have been around for thousands of years, devilish in their origin, meant to pull people into unwholesome thinking, away from God, and not answer their life's deepest questions, and deceive them so they don't have peace, they don't find health and wholeness, and they go from thing to thing, striving for purpose and meaning that Solomon talks about, not ever to find it, you know? And that's why there's a high suicide rate in the transgender community, because they find out it doesn't answer all those questions that I struggled with. And they're left with the reality of they've done things to their body that are irreparable, you know? And so, you know, you can talk about philosophy and it's good to a point. It just helps you understand that kind of thinking and then what the limitations are. It's like in Kant thinking, if I know in my mind what true is true, but outside of me I don't know what is true, then by definition I can't even know if Kant's thinking is true because it's only true to him.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so it's like,
yeah,
But that's where they're at. I mean, it's like, you know, when I was doing all my dissertation, and I think when I finished it, I told my professor, that was one of my readers, I had to land this plane somewhere, and I landed it, I think 70 genders at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, well, they're way past that now, they're way past 100. But that's true to them individually. If they're one of those 70, it's true to them in their mind.
Yeah.
And so that, I mean, that's just like Kant was saying, but there's a huge limitations to that because it philosophically doesn't fly because mm-hmm. it doesn't match reality, which was our discussion last time.
Yeah.
But anyway.
And I think, you know, just hearing that description, that scenario you're describing is like just one of confusion and one of like chaos and uncertainty. And I don't say that in a way that's like, I, as someone who doesn't deal with transgender thoughts, doesn't relate, because I think everyone can relate to that like instability and that fear. But how would you say the peace, like knowing Christ, changes that?
How does Christ change which facet?
Like that, just, you know, the scenario you're describing is one of like, well, I can't really know anything is true, and maybe this is true, but it's really just me in my mind versus anything that my mind projects, like this Kantian type thinking.
Yeah, well, but to know Christ, you have to, because Christ died in time and space. Mm. And so to know Christ is to have a true view of reality, as we talked about last time, that is there, you know, because you're looking for, because if Christ really did die in time and space, and he really did rise in time and space, and the evidence shows that he did, then that changes everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a major way. And so you begin to look at the evidence then. Does the evidence corroborate with the fact that, yes, he rose in time and space from the dead? Mm-hmm. That's the view of truth. That's the correspondence view of truth that we talked about last time. So. Mm-hmm. That would change everything, because I'm looking at truth in a different way.
Yeah.
Not how they look at truth in a coherence view of truth. My little group thinks this is true. Mm-hmm. No, you're looking at, does a statement corroborate with the facts? Mm-hmm. The facts, yeah. There's five levels of facts that prove the resurrection. Gary Habermas has developed them in his book on the resurrection. The first four that he argues are, in my view, pretty much airtight to validate the historicity of the resurrection in time and space. And the fifth one is, he says, is a good argument, but not his best one. But once you leave my little group of coherence and how my little group sees truth, but it may not match reality, and then I start testing reality based on, does it correspond to truth? Then I can easily start leaving my false view and embrace a true view. And once I embrace Christ as the Lord who rose from the dead for my sin, my problem is my sin. Mm-hmm. It warps my thinking. It distorts my viewpoints. But once I come to know Christ and my sin is forgiven and he gives me his spirit to be with me, then he, according to John 14 and John 16, is my teacher, who Jesus said he will guide you to all truth. Mm-hmm. And he begins to guide you toward truth, not toward falsity. Mm-hmm. And then you begin to change.
Yeah.
What is God's truth about sex and gender? You know?
Yeah.
And where does he talk about that? You know? Mm-hmm. Well, he made a man and a woman. And you have XX and XY chromosomes, and those two together are binary and produce another XXXY being. That's all they ever do. Mm-hmm. So you can dress up as the opposite sex. You could cut yourself up to look like the opposite sex. You can drug yourself up to look like the opposite sex, but you are still XXXY based on how God created you. Mm-hmm. And because that corresponds to the facts, and that's what truth is. Mm-hmm. And anything less than that is not what is truth. Mm-hmm. And so once you know Christ and he gives you his spirit to begin to teach you, then it's not what I think, but what has God revealed? Mm-hmm. Well, he made a man and a woman. Well, what did he make them for? Well, the first command in the Old Testament, that he directs toward us as after he made us, is be fruitful and multiply. That's his command. Mm-hmm. That's, so if you go back to philosophy, you know, and study like Aristotle, Aristotle was right when he looked at the world, you know, when he looked at causality, you know, and talked about formal cause and efficient cause and all the way we look at our world, but everything that is made has a cause, and it has a reason why it's caused and what it's for. A mom and a dad were made with different chromosomal capabilities to produce another boy or a girl. Mm-hmm. And gender is just merely a statement realizing, yeah, there's two. There's not 20, there's not 200. So their whole view that denies two genders, has to assume two genders to even argue their point, which begins to defy their system. So they take the revelation that God gives, and then they begin to twist it, you know? And so, no, God made you, no matter, you know, how you're constructed, to be a man or a woman, and no matter of modification, drugs or anything can change your DNA structure. I mean, you are what you are, and gender is just merely a simple illustration of what that is. So that's a view of truth that, and as you draw close to God and ask him to talk to you and teach you, that's what you see. So like when you see where, like in Romans 1 and I think it's in Jude, where Jude talks about sexual sin and stuff like that. It's all related about using the body in a manner that's not natural or not how you were designed. And so as you submit to Christ and follow him and ask him to teach you about sex and gender, you begin to see that yeah, he made you this way, but you can use your body in an unnatural fashion, contrary to how he made you and how he designed you, then that is called sin. Their system would accept anything and everything, but God has boundaries, and anything outside those boundaries would be that which would be sinful. And so that's where the scriptures then say you don't do this, because you're using your body in a way that wasn't designed for, which goes back to Aristotle, which is like everything that's caused is made for a purpose.
Yeah.
And has a design about it to achieve a purpose.
And when you speak about design, it makes me think even like, you know, this whole conversation, right? It's about, we're talking about transgenderism. We're also just talking about in general, just this disconnect between the mind and reality. And that was in the garden. That was, you know, did God really say that this was bad? Like there was this, oh, maybe actually my idea of what this fruit is not what God said. Maybe my idea is different. And I think
that is a good point, because so what the devil was the chief cherubim, the head angel of all of the angels, until pride was found in his heart. Mm-hmm. And when you read Isaiah 14 about the five I wills of Satan, pride is the essence of his five I wills. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be like God so he could be worshiped. So what's he do to mankind? He causes them to question God as he did, and he wants mankind to worship him, and he wants mankind to be duped into the same lie he fell into, that you can be God. Mm-hmm. And so that's how he tempted them. So in transgenderism, what are you doing? Well, you are attempting, you are saying to God, you have made a mistake. You've placed me in the wrong body, and I need to do things through my own power to correct what you have done. And that is acting in a divine status to recreate. That's garden kind of stuff. That's becoming like what the devil tempted mankind to do, is the master of your own fate, and, you know, being your own god or goddess, because you don't like what God gave you.
Yeah, and I do think that is just so fundamentally like the root of this conversation on these, you know, just, and I mean, that's the root of what sin is, right? It's this idea that, well, I can deify myself, and I, you know, and I remember reading in Isaiah not too long ago, and it's talking about like, and it's this passage that's just listing off how the Israelites just created these idols and like have this idolatry. But there's this passage that's really beautiful, and it talks about how like the picture it creates is them, they're creating these idols and they're making these images and they're trying to like, they want to be producers and they want to be creators like God is, and they want to be like, well, this is the way reality is. And then it kind of describes the Israelites as like carrying them, like they're carrying these, and so like they're burdens, like they're not meant to be born right. by
no, Isaiah things. Talks about this, and Isaiah, it's a figure of speech called maledicto, where he or God mocks the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you beat the metal into a form, you nail it to a piece of wood, mm-hmm. you know, and you bow down before this
and
thing.
And you use that wood to cook your food. God. Yeah.
You know, and a lot of those gods were related to sexual perversion. Mm. A lot of those gods, like in the Canaanite structure, Grecian structure, Aphrodite, all their systems, there's sexual perversion among the gods.
Mm.
And then there's sexual perversion among the people.
As a part of the worship of, you know, those gods. Yeah.
So, you know, if you go modifying your body mm-hmm. and changing your body to match what your mind wants, you're perverting what God himself designed.
Mm-hmm.
You're telling him it's not sufficient. Mm-hmm. And so it's an affront to God, who according to Psalm 139, where David talks about how you're fearfully and wonderfully made,
mm-hmm.
you are tampering with the hand of the master designer who made you exactly how he wanted you to be for his purposes. And it's male or female, and it's not up to you to choose to create genders that have never existed before in human history
mm-hmm.
To become your own god or goddess.
Yeah, and I think, and that's such a beautiful passage on like, you know, the validation of like, this is how God created you. And I think, you know, in that story, in that passage in Isaiah, like it's such a beautiful turnaround, because then God flips it and is like, but I created you and I carry you. And it's just almost this like, because you know, there's this human idea that like, oh, if it's true that what I think is the way it is, like, isn't that freedom? Isn't that life-giving? Isn't that like, yeah, just, you know, straight line, I can do whatever the heck I want. But I mean, there's this, but then you realize that that's a burden, and that actually the way it is it's flipped, that we're supposed to pivot and be the ones who are carried and be the ones who were created. And there's right. like, there's such a peaceful surrender, I think, in recognizing that that's who God is. And that's, you know, and
it's living in light of how he made you,
mm-hmm.
you know, not try to make it into something that it's not. That's a deception.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. It's a deception. It's a self-deception. It's a societal deception. And it doesn't match reality. So it can't bring peace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and God's like, just, you know, take my yoke upon you. You know, mm-hmm. it's not heavy. You know, embrace how I've made you, and he can help you move to health and wholeness.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, speaking of like, you know, the heaviness of the burden of kind of buying into ideologies that were, my mind trumps, you know, reality. Where do, looking back, you know, at history, how could we trace what those thought processes, like where they brought up, like where Gnosticism led people through eras? I'm not sure if your studies cover those kinds of things, but.
No.
Okay, yeah.
Nope. No, I only looked at Gnosticism, Rousseau, Jacques Rousseau, and Kant. And then there's many others. I mean, there's mm-hmm. Hobbes, there's a whole bunch of others. But after a 400-page dissertation, I kind of wanted to put the brakes on the thing.
Put the period at the end.
Yeah. So after a while, it's like, I'm only going to talk about these three guys. But yeah, there's many more you could delve into mm-hmm. if you wanted to understand. If you wanted to understand it, James Sire has a book called The Universe Next Door. He's a Christian mm-hmm. apologist. That'd be a good primer for somebody to read that doesn't really read philosophy. He helps you understand how man moved in a chronological format away from understanding God to then deism, you know, to basically ultimately nihilism, mm. where there is no God and nothing matters and we just live for the moment and do whatever you want to do, which is where we are today. Mm. He takes you through all of those steps in probably about 190 pages. It's not a super massive read, but just to give you an understanding of, oh, That's the way, that's why people think like this,
mm. yeah.
you know?
That does sound interesting.
Huh?
That sounds interesting, yeah.
It is, because then it can help you understand how people think like that, even though they don't really know what they're doing in philosophy. but they're espousing some version of philosophy, whether they know it or not.
Yeah.
And it has weaknesses to it that will not lead a person to finding answers, because the thing defeats itself and implodes. And that's where Christ comes in. He doesn't implode. He gives you the answers that you need to fix you. But these are all just, you know, they're the devil's ploy to pull people away. Because if you figure, if the devil can get a person to think that God made a mistake in how he created me, and I'm a woman in a man's body, then I can question Genesis 1 as being valid or not.
What do you mean? Like, how so?
Well, whether, you know, it's true or not. Because obviously he's made a mistake. I could say he's made a mistake with me and all the other friends in my little coherent group of friends that cohere together. We all feel the same way, that we have a mind-body problem. So if it's true that there's this huge mind-body problem, then it's possible that we can question how God created us originally, and therefore we don't have to abide by the biblical concept of creation and what we're created for and all those kinds of things. It's an undermining of what God originally did, how he made a man and a woman. Because there is no way, when you look at the word, when it says that God fashioned Eve from man's side, from like a rib, when it talks about God doing that, the word in the Hebrew text refers to the woman as being man's doctor, not just his helper, but one of the etymological derivations of that word is to be a doctor. So, meaning the wife is going to be such an unusual creation, she will be able to do, you know, a diagnosis of the man and do things for the man that no other man could do for that man. And she's an unusual creation. And if you don't believe me, you're going to be married here. How long?
Like 10 days.
Like 10 days you're going to get married. You know, and you're going to find out that your wife is going to be completely different than any guy you ever known. And she can bring things to your life that no man could ever bring to your life. So it would be an outright deception to think that a man could do body modification, take drug modification, do dress modification, and he could bring to a relationship the same thing that a real woman could. That's a deception, because that is not how God made him. And so again, so you really, it leads to, by definition, unnatural relationships that will not lead to health and wholeness, because that's not a real woman. It's a man who's assuming he's a woman, but he never can be, because God didn't make him that way. But why did God make the woman? Well, for all the things that she's able to do for the man, you know. One of them is for provide children, and et cetera, nurture, care. Your wife's going to be way more perceptive about things than you ever were. She'll remember things really well that you'll tend to forget as a guy. She'll bring tons to your life, tenderness, joy, you know, lots of things. You can't take a person who transitions and give them like the great traits of a woman. Because they're divinely ordered in the DNA structure of what a woman is. I mean, I've read all this stuff, just, you know, how is a man different from a woman? How's a woman different from a man? You know, like men can don't withstand heat as much as a woman can. And I mean, there's a whole there's a list of these things.
Yeah.
So there's no way you can do any kind of transition and change that man into a real woman, or a woman into a real man. Because they'll never be able to have those things, because they come from God's good hand. So then it's a deception.
Yeah.
And it's a deficiency. And therefore it's not the path to great life and health and wholeness.
Yeah. And earlier you were talking about the book that's just kind of tracing this, the path of humanity in this.
Osiris' book.
Yeah. And so what would you say, I've got two questions for you. I'll give you both. One, how would you say where we are today in terms of the mind, the relationship of the mind and the world, how would you say it's different than other times in history? And how would you say that it's similar and echoes similar patterns?
Well, it's changed. I mean, it's changed radically just since I was a kid. I mean, back in the 60s, in high school, in the 70s, back then, you still understood that truth was true. and it was outside of you, and you could reason toward that as you looked at facts. Today, they, you don't have that absolute concept anymore, by and large. And so instead of the society believing generally in truth, now the as we talked about last time, it's just it's a fractured society of multiple like little bubbles of belief systems. And I can believe this, I can believe this, I can believe this. None of them have to match reality. They can defy reality, like transgenderism defies reality, but it's true by definition of that group. And that's history has never had those kind of issues before.
So you'd say you don't think that cycle has happened like in throughout history,
with not the Roman to the Empire magnitude or... that you're seeing today.
Okay.
But then neither then in history did they have mass media production to be able to pump this all around the world, and they didn't have the drugs that they have today to change people. They didn't have the surgical ability to change and stuff like that. So the technology has enabled them to take it to a whole new level. So and then to teach it, it has to be taught all around the world. I mean, literally.
It's crazy how technology just amplifies.
Things. I mean, so it's, you know, it's the world's never had that, you know, because you go back to Aristotle or any of those great thinkers, is they're looking at the world. How do we think about the world? Well, all the great scientists, you know, were originally were great Christians. You know, whether it was Galileo, or you go back and look at all the scientists, and they're looking at their world as something that was ordered, structured, had a system, was cyclical, could be understood, and they could analyze it because they saw that it had a grand design to it that was very intricate. And so they saw a divine being behind what they were looking at. So all their hypotheses and things that they would postulate were based upon a cosmos that was absolutely there, absolutely structured, absolutely ordered. But that's been all thrown out the window. And, you know, now, I mean, even science is affected by thinking that doesn't look at reality, that corroborates to reality. What's impacting even mathematics, like in my home state of California? You know, it doesn't matter, you know, 1 + 1 doesn't have to equal one. It's the whole, they're beginning to question mathematics. How do we teach mathematics? Because they don't want absolutes. But when I was younger, you know, it was a different kind of world. Now it's insane. I mean, as you can see from what they're doing. And then they're forcing everybody, it's like believe it or else.
So you'd say even like in the onset of Gnosticism or even like Kant type like thinking, that was probably never, you're saying that wasn't as prominent as that style of thinking is today?
No, because they didn't have the ability to broadcast it around the entire world as we do today.
It's more localized.
I mean, pick a culture and you're going to encounter all these kinds of things when you go to those different cultures. I see it when I take people to the Middle East. I've seen it when I'm last year flying to Germany. I encountered it on the airplane with a transgender, you know, British soldier sitting next to me, a man who looked very much like a woman, but it was a man. It's all over the place, you know? And so we've never had it to that magnitude, I don't think, in human history before, because we didn't have the capacity to do it with the internet. You know, I mean, back in my day, you had a television with two stations and it was black and white. You know, now your child can sit down with their iPad and connect to the world. That's a whole different enchilada, you know, and therefore good things can be taught and pushed and evil things can be taught. And so it has a greater, you know, ability to be broadcast, I think.
Wow. Well, we'll wrap up here shortly, but I know you've got your talk at the Digging Deeper conference coming up, and I know you have Your talk breaks down into five kind of points, right? You want to give us maybe a teaser, talk about maybe one of those points, maybe how it relates to this conversation.
One of the things that we didn't really talk about is the medical evidence that's available today, more so than when I wrote my dissertation. So mm-hmm. that was been what
like five years ago.
I mean, a lot has happened since then. So I've kept track of medical data since then, because now they have many more studies that they've produced. What you're not being told is the ramifications of the medical findings, and they're not positive. They're very detrimental. So what happens if a young man transitions and begins to take, you know, estrogen or whatever he begins to do, or if a young woman begins to take testosterone? Now they have many studies which show the detrimental nature of these things, what it does to the human body. So to call it gender affirming care, as I said earlier, I think is a misnomer, because there's nothing affirming about it. When you look at the medical evidence, it's destructive care because of what that medical treatment is doing to the human body. That is not what they're telling people.
Like mentally, physically?
Well, that's a whole other discussion. Both, yeah. Like mentally what it does to them is another discussion, but just medically what it does to them. So destroying your cardiovascular system, you know, your pulmonary system, it begins to degrade your system, and it does not lead to life. It shortens your life because your body's not meant to take those things that weren't designed for your body by how God made you. So you're living in an unnatural way, and there's consequences to doing that. And so our culture isn't talking about that at all. You know, media, they're not talking about that. And so that's one of my points is, you know, one of the flaws of their thinking is medicine is a be all end all and helps these people. That is not true. Medicine is very dangerous as people partake of that, and they would really need to look at the studies to understand what happens to you when you start doing this to your body. It's very destructive. So that's one of my 5 points is I'll look at, you know, in details some of those studies, because that's what we need to think about.
And talk
about. Because if you really love somebody, you're going to warn them not to go down that road because of what it will cost.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And we're excited to hear your talk at the Digging Deeper conference coming up.
It should be insightful.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Pastor Marty.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Thanks for tuning in. To hear more, go to digdeeperdc.com.